Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on technology and innovation. It comes in two parts. In the first half hour, we'll highlight the likely sources of future innovation in a conversation between Eric Schmidt, Executive Chairman of Alphabet, and Tom Khalil, Deputy Director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. In the second half of this episode, we'll look at the past and at the innovators of Silicon Valley. This was a conversation that I had with Walter Isaacson. He's president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. And now let's turn to Tom Khalil and Eric Schmidt.
Well, Eric is one of those people who doesn't need any introduction. He's been involved in research, computer science research, at fine institutions like UC Berkeley, go Bears, at Bell Labs at Xerox PARC, but he's also been a leader in a number of businesses, including Sun Microsystems, which is where Eric and I first had the opportunity to work together on an initiative called NetDay, which was all about connecting schools to the internet, at Novell, at Google, and now a new holding company called Alphabet. So why don't you start off by telling...
Well, by the way, I have to introduce you. So you guys probably don't know, but I'm here because this gentleman is a hero of mine. He has spent 20 years, and I know this because I physically know it, and I spent the time in the White House with him, trying to make technology policy for America and the world scale, get money for us, and invest in things that mattered. It is a great honor for me to be with you.
Thank you.
And so we're clear, he's still there. He's the number two in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House.
Thank you. Thank you. So why don't you tell the audience a little bit about Alphabet, because I'm sure everyone has heard of Google.
I feel like it's like Sesame Street. You're in charge of letters. So we've announced G, of course, and we've also talked about Google Life Sciences, and we have some more coming. I think likely ones would include some of the ones that we've already announced. Calico is a business that's looking into essentially aging research and businesses. We already have a subsidiary called Nest, which is doing very well. And there's a lot of emphasis on our access business, which you know as Google Fiber. We're busy separating. It's typical of Google to announce this without actually having worked out all the details. And so that's what we're doing now. You'll see that over the next six, 9 months.
So why don't we start off with talking about some of the underlying technology trends? What do you think are the major technology trends that you're seeing, whether it's increases in global connectivity or advances in enabling technologies like deep learning? What do you see as the key drivers?
I think for this audience, because we're in San Francisco, I just like to presume the broad success of smartphones, fast networks, and cloud computing. Most people are still talking about that. We sort of assume that's all going to happen. The industry has now moved to that architecture, and it's going to be, you know, years for the incumbents to move over and the customers will move over. But we know that the world is better off when you're on a fast network, wired or wireless, a gigabit wired and a LTE network getting faster. We know that people are now essentially living on smartphones and mobile devices of one kind or another. And we know that the old architectures are giving away to cloud computing, which is scalable computing. So let's just take that for granted. So the question is, what's next? In the last few years, something which I did not think was going to happen has begun to really happen. And it started with language recognition, voice recognition, and computer vision. And it is now the case that computers see better than humans. That is literally their visual resolution, their ability to accurately identify things that are in scenes and so forth is mechanically and in a measured way more accurate than humans, even when humans are perfectly awake and perfectly sober. Right? So that has a lot of implications for things like self-driving cars. So when I'm in a self-driving car, which I still find rather exciting, I'm sort of comforted by the fact that it sees better than I do, with or without my glasses on. That means that over the next decade or so, as this technology broadly becomes available, you're going to see a lot of impacts of better sight. I'll give you another example is radiologists. I would worry if I were a radiologist right now, simply because the visual image that is a radiologist's work is better done as a computer image by a computer doing diagnostics. They can just do it better. Mm-hmm. Now, with that and with this advances that we've gotten with speech, it's reasonable to expect that we really will be conversing with these devices and we'll be interacting with them because they have the ability to see in a mechanical sense. And then there's this huge debate in the industry of what happens after that, right? What we know is that things that are repetitive, especially low-level routine activities of humans, will be replaced by computer and automation. By low-level, I mean things which are repetitive that don't require a lot of creativity or a lot of judgment. And by the way, we know this because this has been going on for my whole life. And in one form or another, it's been going on for almost 200 years. So it's likely to continue. There's a huge debate as to how far does it go, how high does it go, when does it get to the point where it feels that it's almost human-like, and so forth. And my view of that is it's largely science fiction.
Right. And so how long do you think it'll take before a computer can read a college-level textbook and answer the questions at the back?
It depends on what subject. There are quite a few research projects which produce college-level papers which, when inserted with human-level papers, get reasonable-level grades, which is not the same thing as the best, or maybe the grading standards are uneven, or God knows. So it looks like we can do sort of normal quality, sort of average quality work of that kind. When people ask that question, they're usually actually asking a harder question, which is, when can a computer do as well as the best human? When can a computer do better than a human? And again, there is not agreement on that.
Right.
For many, many reasons. And the underlying mechanics of machine learning, which is what I'm talking about, it works incredibly well when you have an immensely large amount of data and a strong measurement function. I'll give you an example of Google, Alphabet, whatever. You have a very clear measurement function, which is people are clicking on the ads, people are clicking on the links. So we can measure that. So that's amenable to that. I'll give you an example where I would love machine learning to provide great value, and I'll pick something horrific, terrorism. Right? The good news is there's so few terrorist incidents that it's very difficult to sort of look at the universe of terrorist incidents and sort of come to
an outcome. Because it's too sparse.
It's just too sparse.
Yeah.
But let's take a look at, I'll give you another example, which I'm very excited about, is healthcare. It's crazy to me that these healthcare systems have these huge internal proprietary Epic-based EHRs, and you helped set this up, so great job. You got the data there, right? But what are we doing to analyze it? I want to be able to walk into the doctor and the doctor say, I know why you're here. I said, like, how do you know? He said, my computer told me you'd be coming in today because we predicted that with your current declining health, you're going to need to see me today. Now you sit there and you say, is that possible? It might be. But we're at the point now, think of it as pattern matching, right? Remember I said vision? What is vision? It's pattern matching. Well, let's say that that generalizes to the healthcare record. So you kind of look at the patterns, you begin to see the patterns. I've since learned in talking to people in the medical profession that a lot of what they do at the analytical level is really pattern matching, looking for these.
Right.
So there's hope for two things. One is much greater advice to doctors, which will clearly be very good from health, but also the discovery things which humans don't see, patterns that are across such a large cohort that our intuition isn't strong enough.
Right. So I think that, you know, the continued advance of machine learning combined with these, you know, huge amounts of data, that seems like a pretty safe bet. But what are some things that you think are potential black swans that are low probability but high consequence?
Well, I'll give you an example of, let's pick something like chemistry, okay? And I'm not a chemist, but roughly what happens in chemistry is people, there's huge empires of businesses that build new chemicals and materials and so forth in business, either for you know, sort of lotions or mechanical things or fabrics or surfaces. Now, we have a good enough understanding of the way carbon works, essentially, that we can probably use the computers to help generate these compounds faster. So if you could accelerate that industry faster, right, how much is that worth to our economy? A lot, right? A lot. A lot of new products, a lot of new services. You and I were participants some years ago in a manufacturing task force at the White House, where we were presented with this extraordinary array of new manufacturing surfaces, right? Much lighter materials and so forth. Again, if we can accelerate, that's an example. My favorite example is the following. Take the chemistry book and have a computer sort of read it.
Right.
And imagine that the computer could actually assemble all of the formulas with enough work and actually produce something new.
Right.
Now that might lead to some serious accelerations. Now, I don't know what the probability of that is. We're nowhere near being capable to do that, but that would be a wonderful outcome.
Yeah. What are some of the benefits of these emerging technologies that you're most excited about, not only in the United States, but in a developing country context?
Well, everything we're talking about, of course, this is the World Affairs Council, so thank you for having this. It needs to be put in context that the biggest achievement in the last 20 years has been the taking of people, roughly 2 billion people, from abject poverty to what they would consider to be middle class and what we would consider to be lower middle class. Literally going from worried about hunger, worried about education, worried about personal safety, to the point where they have a moderately acceptable life from our perspective. Mm-hmm. Right, that achievement, which is an achievement of globalization and connectivity and trade and so forth, is not to be sneezed at. Right? And the economic growth, and much of the economic growth in the world over the next couple decades, will be coming from those people as they move up into what we consider to be solid middle class. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm very excited about that. And a lot of that has now, it's now clear, occurred because of the prevalence of connectivity networks and smartphones. Mm-hmm. And I think there's evidence that we're going to get another 2 to 3 billion people who today are not connected will be connected to the internet through newer generations of even more powerful and even less expensive smartphones. And that will change their lives in innumerable ways.
What role are companies like Google and Facebook playing in extending connectivity in developing countries?
Well, the first and foremost thing that we're doing is the Android operating system is by far the number one operating system that everybody's going to be using there, and the low-cost phones will almost all be using Android. And of course, Android has the benefit of being free to such people, so we start with the correct price. The issue with connectivity is largely one that the provider charges are much higher on an income-adjusted basis. They're infinitely higher than what we pay. So the solution there is greater competition, better technology, and various programs such as the ones Facebook and Google are doing. In our case, we've been funding fiber cables and other things to connect these countries to get them linked up together. I'm very proud mm-hmm. of that.
Great. So there's a growing interest both in government and the private sector and philanthropy in the identification of 21st century moonshots. So in the same way that President Kennedy said, let's put a man on the moon, we decided to sequence the human genome. President Obama unveiled support for the BRAIN Initiative, which is aimed at dramatically increasing understanding of how the brain processes and encodes information. Elon Musk has said, I want to die on Mars, but not on impact. What do you think are some of the of these grand challenges or 21st century moonshots that you think deserve more attention?
And I should tell you all that Tom wrote a moonshot document that I used as my reference, so you might want to add a little bit to this as well. When I think about it, I start with looking at what's happening in biology. And the reality is that in all of our lifetimes, synthetic biology does appear to be able to allow us to regrow at least small parts of our body. And the change of that, which is the way medicine and health is mm-hmm. is going to be amazing.
So we could eliminate the waiting list for an organ donation.
Yeah, so most people would like to regrow their entire body when they're older. And that's not the current plan, although maybe in the future. But at the moment, people, especially in transplant and other kinds of situations where there's acute illness, there's hope that your own organ can be grown. And there's a lot of people who think that that's achievable, in our, again, reasonably mm-hmm. soon in our terms. If you take a look at progress in cancer, the work that's going on in the genetics revolution and the ability to statistically pinpoint the causes of the cancer and cancer-related diseases has accelerated because of supercomputers. Google, I guess I'd say Google / Alphabet, has been working with the Broad Institute, which is one of the centers to do this, to build a platform for genomics to accelerate the manipulation of full genomes. And everybody here knows that the cost of having your genome sequenced has been falling faster than Moore's Law. So there's every reason to think that in the future, what will happen is you go to the doctor, there'll be some sort of sequencer, they'll take some biologic, get it be sequenced, and they'll say, oops, you know, there we go, and they'll do some database comparison. What gets interesting is when you start getting a large enough database of that information anonymized, you can begin to predict drug interactions at the genetic level, mm-hmm. right, which you've never been able to do, and it's the dawn of real personalized medicine. You mentioned the BRAIN Initiative. Mm-hmm. There are debates as to whether the correct approach is to look at the way the brain works or look at digital versions of how thinking and reasoning might work. The transformation for cities is turning out to be very interesting. There's a lot of evidence that cities are where most of the innovation, most of the growth will occur. I'm going to China in a week or so. The Chinese leadership has announced that they still need 6 cities for 300 million people to move from rural to city. Now, by the way, if you do a little bit of math, that's cities of 50 million people. And they have to be built new because the current cities with 50 million people are full. Mm-hmm. Right, so imagine what that means from infrastructure planning right. and so forth. And I think that they're serious about it. And there are many, many things that we can do with respect to making cities much safer, much more efficient, much better from a transportation perspective. To make city life both more prosperous, more desirable, and frankly, we might as well do it because it's going to happen anyway. Mm-hmm. So those are some examples.
Mm-hmm. On the flip side, what do you think are some of the risks that we should be worried about? So obviously, there's a lot of people who've been concerned about the notion of an intelligence explosion where artificial intelligence becomes...
So we're clear. I'm in favor of more intelligence.
So what do you think are the risks that are legitimate for people to worry about? Should we be about, an electronic Pearl Harbor, which is something that people have talked about for
On the first part of your question, mm-hmm. I think we've all grown up with the best Hollywood can ever make, and they always have bad outcomes involving this scenario.
Right.
I think that's the unlikely scenario. This mm-hmm. is science fiction. We're working very, very hard to make humans smarter. Google has already made you smarter in that everything I've said, you can now check and see if I'm correct or not. And you couldn't do that 20 years ago on this location or mm-hmm. 10 years ago, or maybe you get the idea. You'd have to go to the library. So now you can just decide if you agree with me or not, and it holds me to a higher mm-hmm. standard and you as well. We've adapted to that. We're smarter as a result. Now take that fast forward. That makes sense to me. I do worry about the militarization of cyberspace. And there are a series of articles about the number of countries that now have what I would call offensive cyber war capabilities. When I started looking at this, it was commonly assumed that it was America, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, and the Israelis. That was just the common assumption. Nobody really knew. And the common assumption now is a much larger set. And so we're going to have to go through some sort of a broad conversation about the appropriate and inappropriate use of those at a state level. We've already seen from China a large number of attacks on American firms, including Google, obviously, which are pretty clear they're state-sponsored. Now, they're done perhaps by individuals that are not in the military, but when you trace it down, it appears to be a deliberate strategy by people associated with the government or the government itself to steal intellectual property from America to advance their own industries and their own plans. That just doesn't seem right to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I also wanted to talk about governance, and particularly how does the government, the private sector, and civil society work together to solve problems. What are some examples of public-private partnerships that Google has been involved in that you think worked well? And
well,
that
we've
you're particularly
sent
proud of?
A lot of our employees to the government, right? And most of the people who seem to be really doing well in the government in uh-huh. the tech sector seem to be ex-Google employees. Uh-huh. So that's our contribution. Uh-huh. And these are people with a great sense of civic service and so forth. We obviously encourage that. Mm-hmm. My observation with the government is that the time, I remember this from years ago, and I think it's still true, the government is designed precisely to move slowly, mm-hmm. and our industry is designed to precisely move quickly, right? And the incentives are misaligned. Mm-hmm. And so the more of the kind of people that we can find here in the Valley and San Francisco and so forth, who are willing to take a significant personal cost to go in and try to influence it, the better. You and I have spoken about, just imagine putting some tech-minded folks into each of the major cabinet operations and thinking about doing things differently, right? Reaching their consumers, measuring things differently, delivering services differently. The government has just now, one of the things that you did when you were in the Clinton administration is you worked to get everyone to have an email address, right? And this was considered very impressive at the time, Tom. Mm-hmm. And that was because they had some weird standard email, and now, of course, they have proper email. So that was progress. So under the Obama administration, we now have everyone has a website, and they have to say what they're doing, right? So again, there's some lag there, and that lag is a productivity lag.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about sort of what collaboration with the U.S. government, but what about in other governments or in developing countries as well?
A lot of my time is spent visiting with the leadership of these other countries, and they vary quite widely. And I'll make some broad generalities, and obviously there are always exceptions. When you go to China, you have a sense that these are people in a very big hurry, and it's very entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. They're building a modern society, maybe different from the way we like it, faster than has ever been done before. And you see that when you talk to the regulators and so forth. They have this unfortunate problem that they want to control information, which ultimately doesn't work. That's part of the principles of the internet. We fight them on that. If you think about Europe is full of incredibly smart people, incredibly educated people, continues to resist the pace of change that American firms. And the politics are, I'm not talking about the regulation, but the politics are roughly anti-American. They invented a term called GAFA, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, to identify the four.
The four horsemen of the apocalypse.
That's right. Uh-huh. Another term they invented, but we're not going to talk about that. But in fact, there are more firms, and there mm-hmm. are initiatives in Europe, for example, to try to prevent platforms from spreading all throughout Europe, which I think is completely misinformed, and I say this to them. They have other problems. A typical way, if you want to torment a European leader, is you say, how long does it take to start up a company in your country? Mm-hmm. And they often don't know. And then they say that they'd like to have the Silicon Valley success, and I said, look, just copy our rules. There's no secret as to how Silicon Valley has done this, and frankly, as much as I'd like to tell you that it's the weather, it's not the weather, okay?
That helps.
It's the educational system, mm-hmm. it's the limited liability, mm-hmm. It's the ability to take risks, it's the decriminalization of failure, just all those kinds of things. And there are reasons why this model continues to excel here, and they need to respond to that. Mm-hmm. The rest of the world is hoping to skip in the industrial age up to connectivity. And their hope, I'll give you an example. We were mentioning earlier about we were in Kenya sort of walking it. And you get a sense that there are plenty of smart people with smartphones. You really can build this to make happen. So I think they'll get there.
Mm-hmm. One question we got from the audience was, what are you going to do once you run out of the 26 letters in the alphabet?
We're probably going to use transcendental numbers. 0, 1, E, pi, rho. That's the most likely. But Google always reserves the rights to surprise you at the end.
Uh-huh, okay. And are there some things that you would see as being off the table, e.g. online gambling?
We've looked at a fair number of things like that, and we've tried to stay on sort of a proper side of a lot of those questions. Mm-hmm. I would doubt that Google Alphabet would get involved in military things. I think historically we've stayed away from them. I would doubt we would get close to things like gambling and those sorts of activities. Without passing comment on them, we're just busy with sort of the core things that I'm talking about.
Right. Another question. Discussion is largely focused on the positive potential that technology can have on human lives, from education to health to transport. But what aspect of our lives should technology be pushed back so that we can retain our human capabilities?
Well, I'm working on my own project in this area, which is I'm attempting to turn off my mobile phones during dinner. So, now, I've since learned that dinner is 90 minutes long, uh-huh. and I can just about do it, especially if I take a peek when the dessert is happening. Uh-huh. And a number of us went to North Korea, and which is the last place where there is, in fact, no connectivity. And the joke was that our hands were twitching for hours until eventually we sort of forgot. Uh-huh. And the moment we returned to Beijing, that testament of capitalism and free speech, we immediately turned our devices on. Uh-huh. So there's something about these tools, and I think it's important that they serve in our interest and that we don't serve in their interest.
Right.
I use the dinner one as an example, but I think that you all get the metaphor pretty well. I worry about the implications for jobs as mm-hmm. this whole yeah. purpose of this conference. Mm-hmm. And in particular, what I worry about is that there are people who are employed, who are not motivated, not happy, don't want to come to work, not particularly interested in anything. They're just sort of like blah. They're the ones that are going to be at risk here, mm-hmm. right? There are plenty of equivalent people who are quick starters, ready for something new, they're going to do great. So you've got to think about that person who is displaced. Again, this is not a new subject, but we need to have that conversation.
I want to wrap up by talking a little bit about philanthropy and ask you to reflect a little bit about your own philanthropy, but what you think might be done to inspire to get more of our successful entrepreneurs involved earlier in their career as opposed to, you know, waiting until they retire.
One of the observations is that this generation, my generation of people, sort of the baby boomers, as a group we retire, it'll be the largest amount of philanthropic money ever raised by many factors. And so there's a great danger that that money, because these people will, people eventually do die and they really will give the money away before they die. There's a great danger that a lot of that money is going to be wasted. And the tech industry is much more specific and much more measurable in the way we behave, and that's true in philanthropy as well. So I think the first observation is that there is an opportunity for guidance around what is most important. And without commenting on the other things, anything involving education, entrepreneurship, getting this next generation capable of creating great new ideas, great businesses, great wealth, that's a wonderful way of transmitting it over. There's a long history of philanthropy in the support of science and in the arts. And I'm sure that the arts will get taken care of. There are plenty of patrons of that. But you and I and a number of people have been working on how do we get more money into basic research.
Right.
I should warn everybody that much of what you're using today comes from basic research that was done 20 or 30 years ago by institutions that no longer have that funding, right? Bell Labs,
Xerox Park.
Xerox Park, and so forth. And there's I'll give you another interesting statistic in the healthcare. We were studying this at the White House. The peak of NIH funding was around 2008 or so, and then there was a real cut in NIH funding, National Institutes of Health, by about 30% in real dollars, which is an extraordinary reduction. People like the world I care about was largely flat. So what did that do? Well, the average time for getting a grant, if you're a researcher in that field, went up by a decade, right? The first grant. So there, in fact, is understood that there's a gap between the sort of graduate student with great potential postdoc and becoming a proper researcher of a decade, right? That's a hole that can be filled and needs to be filled by philanthropy.
Any questions that I didn't ask that you'd like to answer?
That's a Kissinger question.
Yeah.
I think my message to you all is that I am, having worked on this now for the last few years in my new job, I'm actually of the opinion that the rate is about to accelerate pretty quickly. That you're here in the Bay Area, and every dinner, every lunch, there's a new profound idea. And a lot of this is because the cost of entry is so much lower. The platforms, whether they're scientific or genetic or software or hardware design platforms, are now so much cheaper, that the barrier to entry is so much cheaper, that the level of innovation that we've seen now is simply a precursor to a far greater expansion of that, which I view as almost completely overwhelmingly wonderful.
So we're improving the improvement process.
I believe that this will happen fast enough that I hope you remember that I told you that this is not the end of something, but rather the beginning of something much, much more powerful.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. We've just heard from Tom Khalil of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and Eric Schmidt, who's chairman of Alphabet. We're now going to turn to a conversation that I had with Walter Isaacson, president of the Aspen Institute. So we're here with Walter Isaacson, the author most recently of a new book, The Innovators, and it's a history of the digital age and also of sort of how innovation happens. But I want to start with something very current, Walter, and that is that one of the characteristics of the digital age is that while it's created tremendous wealth, it's also exacerbated some disparities. And some of the folks you're writing about are taking the lessons they've learned from their own innovations and applying it to social change and trying to right that wrong in their view.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about innovators of the digital age is they know it's all about inclusion, not exclusion. And so you look at Melinda and Bill Gates, what they're doing, and Melinda Gates especially on the role of women and in both tackling economic opportunity issues, but also, you know, just tackling all the problems of society. I know Laura Andreessen has been very active and with you. And so you see people who have been part of the digital revolution realizing that our technological tools are only as good as we make them, and that we should use them and the wealth that's been created by this new technological boom to say, how do we make it a more inclusive, more equal society in which everybody has an opportunity? That can happen through the technology, as I'm hoping it will happen with K-12 education in America, where technology will give everybody a more equal shot at it. But we have to be on guard. I mean, if you look around, sometimes it exacerbates a digital divide between rich and poor.
And, of course, Bill Gates has taken that lesson that collaboration across sectors works with things like Gain and Gavi, enterprises that combine the private sector and the philanthropic sector. Is this one of the lessons of the digital age?
Absolutely. If you go back to the very beginning of what I would call our modern digital age in the 1940s, there was a great collaboration that happened around this area in the Bay Area of California, but also around the country in Boston, New York, and other places, of a collaboration between government, which helped fund some of the great research of that time, universities, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, around the University of Pennsylvania, around the country, and then private enterprises. And I think we've lost that ability to have a not only cross-sector collaboration, but a collaboration between government, philanthropies, NGOs, corporations, and academia.
So as you let's sort of talk about innovation and how it happens and the nature of collaboration. When is collaboration an asset? What are the roles of teams on the one hand, and what's the role of the individual?
You know, we biographers sometimes feel we distort history because we make it seem like it's the individual, the guy or gal sitting in a garage or a garret. They have a light bulb moment and innovation happens. When I wrote about Steve Jobs, I marveled at what a brilliant individual he was as a visionary. But what was particularly impressive is he always found the right partner, starting with Steve Wozniak all the way through Tim Cook. And that ability to form teams is what made him so successful. When I asked him at one point what was the your product you're proudest of, I thought he'd say the iPod or the iPhone. And he said, you know, making a product is hard, but making a company where people can collaborate and create products one after the other, that's the main thing to do. So whether it's Mark Zuckerberg and how he's created Facebook, not just around one product, but as a team with Sheryl Sandberg, or the way the Google guys have done it with, you know, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, bringing in Eric Schmidt to create a team at Google, that ability to create a team and collaborate is the mark of successful visionaries, as opposed to some visionaries who have a great vision, but they can't execute. So it turns out to be pretty much just hallucination.
So, you know, we tend to celebrate the fact that now one can collaborate across geographies. But one of the points you make in the book is that collaboration is best when it's place-based. Say a word about that.
You and I know this from the Aspen Institute. You think you can do things through Skype or Google Hangouts, and you can do things across the world digitally. But every time we get together digitally, it sort of increases our desire to have some face-to-face meetings, some meetups, or to come convene, as you do, with the philanthropy group at the Aspen Institute. And I think whether it starts with, you know, Bell Labs, where you had corridors of people who were theoretical physicists, but also pole climbers who knew how to amplify a signal across the country, when they all got together in the hallways and they had serendipitous encounters, that physical convening, I think, is how you finish each other's sentences. You get inspired by other people. It's why Steve Jobs, when he created the Pixar headquarters, wanted one big atrium everybody had to walk through. It's why Marissa Mayer correctly said that you shouldn't try to telecommute every day. You should come in to Yahoo headquarters, because collaboration and creativity happen in person. That was her quote. And, you know, she knows digital tools, but that notion of collaborating in person, it's why we do meetings in Aspen, Washington, San Francisco for the Aspen Institute. But it's also why people who have met each other, you know, as Aristotle said, we're a social animal, met each other online, they tend to want to say, okay, let's get together and really brainstorm.
So taking back, though, to those moments of national purpose, because I think we do have that moment of national purpose around education right now, and the current administration very, very focused on this, and you personally have been very focused on this. There was another moment of national mobilization, and that was the space race, right? And you did mention that Eisenhower helped, you know, mobilize resources and public attention around it. Talk about its role in the digital age.
Sure. I mean, Eisenhower decides to start a space agency, and then Kennedy, right when he comes into office, says we'll send a man to the moon and return him by the end of the decade. You know, that just spurs a lot of things. For example, the transistor had been invented, but you had to have a guidance system and a computer in the nose cone of a rocket. So that spurs the invention of microchips. It makes microchips, which Intel, Texas Instruments, and others were creating, into something that they know that there's a huge market for. It also helps spur the development of computers. And so that ability to say, we have a national purpose here, ends up throwing off enormous benefits.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, Gordon Moore comes into your story at that moment. Of course.
Gordon Moore, who I had the chance for this book to spend a lot of time with, you know, he comes up with the notion when he's at Fairchild Semiconductor and then Intel that the processing power of a microchip will double every 18 months or so. And that helps give a roadmap to, you know, the development of everything from the personal computer to our cell phones. We know which way computers are heading, and it's held pretty much true. But one of the things about Fairchild Semiconductor, which Bob Noyce, Andy Grove does it when they form Intel, and Gordon Moore do, is they know they have a market for it because our government is funding a lot of really cool things, the space race being one of them, but even military things like Minuteman missiles needed it. I'm not hoping for a lot more wartime spending, but I am hoping for government to have a specific purpose and say we can rebuild America's infrastructure, we can reinvigorate America's schools, we can map the human brain just like we did the human genome, and we can do new forms of connecting our technology to bioengineering.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things you say about Silicon Valley is that the digital age is not only did folks innovate around technology and around its use, but they also innovated when it came to corporate culture, to management.
Absolutely. You look at one of the great inventions of our time, and it was Intel and Atari forming this sort of laid-back, non-hierarchical corporate culture in which everybody had a right to share ideas. You didn't have to go through a chain of command. Also, around that time when Fairchild is becoming Intel, you have Arthur Rock and people who've come from the East Coast, and they form the concept of venture capital where people take risks. And they even bet on people who have failed before. We're one of the few places on Earth where, you know, failure is not an option, it's a line on your resume. And failure is an option, right, it's a line on your resume.
As long as you're learning from it, it's very much.
Right. But it's also, if you're afraid of failing, you're never really going to be a great innovator. And that's what the whole systems we have now of startup companies, entrepreneurs, venture capital, non-hierarchical workplaces, places like Google that not only produce their products, but envision all sorts of products from driverless cars to Google Glass that are great.
Yeah. So let's talk about the characteristics of an innovator, the sort of personality traits. Risk-taking is one of them, as you know. Yeah. But what are the other ones?
You know, I think the ability to connect the humanities to technology. A lot of people talk about artificial intelligence and the singularity is about to come take over our lives. Maybe so, but that always seems 20 years away. In fact, since the early 1950s, people saying it's 20 years away, it's 20 years away. In the meantime, as J.C.R. Licklider said in the 60s when he was talking about artificial intelligence, he said, how do we make our machines more intimately connected to us? So if you look at the history of the digital age, it's people who had a feel for humanities and for humans and how to make those human connections to machines more personal, more intimate. That's why we got away from the big hulking computers to the personal computer. That's why Steve Jobs said, let's put 1,000 songs in your pocket. Or the people at Texas Instruments decided, hey, we've gotten the transistor and we manufacture it. Let's create the transistor radio so radios can become more personal. And now, whether it's Apple Watch or Google Glass, that ability of a computer actually to hold our hand and touch our wrists and look us in the eye, that to me is more important than the pursuit of artificial intelligence.
And it's interesting that, you know, I mean, as most folks who've taken a look at this book know, you open it with Lord Byron's daughter. And
Ada
you say,
Lovelace.
Yeah, and you say that she got the connection between the humanities and technology. In her case, it was between poetry and mathematics. But
exactly.
Say something about that.
You know, and I use her as a symbolic character. She opens and closes the book. She's Lord Byron's daughter, so she's... has an appreciation for poetry. Her mother, Lady Byron, was not particularly fond of Lord Byron when Ada was growing up and had her tutored mainly in mathematics. But Ada develops what she calls poetical science. You can read wonderful books about her, Betty Toole, Dorothy Stein. Many people have written great books about Ada Lovelace, and they all stress the fact that she understood poetry, but she applied it to machines and technology. Her father was a Luddite, seriously. I mean, he defended the followers of Ned Ludd, who was smashing the mechanical looms that were using punch cards in the early 1800s in England to weave tapestries. But Ada loved the way those punch cards instructed the looms to weave patterns. And when her friend Charles Babbage was creating a calculating machine called the analytical engine that did numbers, and it was using punch cards, she said, those punch cards can make it do more than just numbers. It can do anything that can be notated symbolically, such as music. It can compose music. It can make beautiful patterns and art. It can process words. And that's the notion of a general computer that comes from connecting this feel for beauty, art, and the humanities to technology and engineering and science.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, making technology personal. So back to the attributes. One of the attributes of innovators, certainly in the digital age, has been a kind of resistance to authority. Say something about that.
When it comes to the personal computer, because, you know, in the early days of the computer, they were considered rather Orwellian. They were going to be run by the Pentagon or the power structure or the elite or the corporate America, the government. And then, especially in the Bay Area of California, you have a mixture of a whole bunch of tribes ranging from people who are in the anti-war movement, community organizers who were trying to organize, you know, sort of neighborhood schools and community centers. You had the hippies who were doing the electric Kool-Aid acid test, and electronics geeks and wireheads and phone freakers and, you know, people who worked, for the electronics company. And they have one particular thing in common, which is they tend to resist authority. They tend to think that, as Stuart Brand said when he did the Whole Earth Catalog and he was at the epicenter of these tribes in the Bay Area, it's we want access to tools. We want hands-on access to tools. And that's something that the hackers and the community organizers and the Whole Earth communalists could all agree on. And so that notion of taking computing power and bringing it to the personal computer became sort of a mantra of the Homebrew Computer Club, which is where Apple is germinated by Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs. But also when Bill Gates creates BASIC for the first hobbyist computer, the Altair, it gets shared by members of the Homebrew Computer Club. And that sort of sharing peer-to-peer mentality, that resistance to corporate authority, I think is embedded in how the internet was designed and the personal computer.
Now, as you make very clear throughout the book, this all takes teams, but there are also some individuals who stand out. And one of them, Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web 25 years ago.
We're about to celebrate the big anniversary.
It's the big birthday. that's someone who said, you know, he was a lone inventor, if I understand correctly.
Right.
He also said, don't patent this. Make this. Give this to the public domain.
Well, he was more than most people in the digital age, a singular inventor. He's sitting there at CERN, the Atom Smasher in Switzerland, and he has to make sure people there can collaborate. People who speak different languages can share research. For that matter, computers that speak different language can share things. So he comes up with a set of protocols that allow a hypertext transfer and markup language that rides on top of the internet. And it's there built for collaboration, even though he needed a partner. Kalu, a great Belgian engineer, is sort of his bird dog who helps get it through the bureaucracy at CERN. And then it becomes a very collaborative effort to let the web spread. Mark Andreessen, we've just talked about his wife. He's just a corn-fed, big old hulking student at the University of Illinois, and he creates Mosaic, which is a browser that allows ordinary folks to just download it, use it easily, get on the web. It's a creation of Mosaic, I think, in late 93, early 94, that allows the web, which had about 700 websites at the beginning of 94, to have 10,000 at the end of 1994. So even products that have one particular visionary, they end up being built collaboratively. And just as I said earlier on, that vision without execution is hallucination. Execution without a great visionary is barren. And so it takes visionaries like Mark Andreessen, Tim Berners-Lee, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, others, Gordon Moore and Bob Noyce, to make it so that a collaborative team is creative, imaginative.
You think about Mark Andreessen and what he did, and Bill Gates, what he did. They were 19-year-olds when they made these contributions.
I remember I was at Time Magazine. We put him on the cover, and he was barefoot. but it is true that I think this sort of notion of being able to risk things. I mean, Bill Gates drops out of Harvard and goes to Albuquerque, where they're assembling the Altair, so he can write BASIC for it. And Mark Andreessen just sits there and looks at the web, and he's stunned by it. And as a graduate student, he and two or three other people work together and form a web browser. Obviously, Mark does it in his dorm room at the University of Illinois. Larry Page and Sergey Brin do it as graduate students at Stanford. And I think there's an exuberance, just a passion. A lot of them make money doing it, but I don't think they were driven initially by the money. They were driven initially by the exuberance and the passion of saying, let's work together with people and create something cool and new. Mm-hmm. Google's the best example because Google looks like it's some computer thing that searches the web, but what it actually does is it aggregates all the human judgments people make each day when they put links on their websites. And so it's sort of, as Ada Lovelace would appreciate, the ultimate connection of technology with human imagination and judgment.
And before Larry Page and Sergey Brin, there were two other Stanford students, Jerry Yang and
David Filo.
But what I love, I learned in your book.
And by the way, you notice they all come in partnerships usually.
That's
whether
right.
It's Woz and Steve Jobs or Bill Gates and Paul Allen or the Filo and
Jerry Yang.
Jerry and Yang and obviously Sergey and Larry. And I think one of the cool things, it's like the Lennon-McCartney concept, Joshua Wolfshank writes about that, of having somebody you can bounce ideas off of is awesomely important.
And
it was Robert Kailiw, I forgot to give his first name, who was sort of a partner of Tim Berners-Lee at CERN.
And what's interesting is that they meet each other and form a bond at a relatively young age. I mean, it's not to say it can't happen later.
I love the story of Larry and Sergey. I think Larry is admitted to Stanford as a graduate student. He has an orientation program where he meets Sergey, who's one of the guides. You're ahead of him at Stanford Graduate School, just in San Francisco. And they spend the entire day arguing with each other, then finishing each other's sentences, and then deciding to make a dent in the universe.
Right. And friends for life, as well as colleagues for life.
Yeah, occasionally you have the fallings out. But, for example, if you look at Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, they were, you know, very different. And it truly is Jobs who builds the company. And Woz gets left behind a little bit. But I remember the very last product launch I went to, you know, that was Steve Jobs' last product launch. There was Woz in the waiting room, in the audience, and getting a shout out from Steve. And likewise, Bill Gates really was the visionary and driving force, not Paul Allen, you know, not Steve Ballmer. And so sometimes there's a bit of tension there, but I do think that you find that a Bill Gates really, really knows how to partner with people. And, you know, people have to get used to the fact that whether it's a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or whatever, even in a partnership, there's often a driving force, and they deserve to be given free rein. I mean, you and I have never created Apple or Microsoft, and so you got to give these guys credit, even if they were, you know, a bit aggressive.
One of the things that Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, and you have in common is this ability to talk about technology in terms that non-technologists can understand. What's marvelous about this book is it is so easy to grasp complex notions of engineering and technology. So it's a striking fact about the book.
Well, thank you. I mean, my dad was an engineer. I loved soldering circuits when making ham radios and Heathkits when I was a kid. And I think, you know, just as Ada Lovelace could look at one of her father's lines, like, you know, she walks in beauty, you know, like the night, or another poetic image like rosy-fingered dawn, and picture it, she was also able to picture what a mathematical equation did, to visualize things. And I actually have always loved, I mean, if you look at Einstein's theories, they're very visual. He did them as visual thought experiments. He imagined what would it be like to ride alongside a light beam? Would the waves seem stationary to me? And then he visualized what would it be like on a fast-moving train if lightning struck both ends? How would different people see the lightning strike? Or that the universe was gravity curved space and time. These are truly beautiful things. And I try in my book, even if it's the transistor or the internet or internet protocol or a hypertext transfer protocol, these are things we all write, you know, HTTP occasionally. But if you actually visualize how they work, I think you're less detached from your technology. There's some alienation that occurs when you think that the web is magic instead of a real person who was, you know, just a normal guy, Tim Berners-Lee, actually worked with ideas of Ted Nelson and other people and figured out how does this work. Then you're not as alienated from the technology. You're more comfortable with it.
So let me take you to a policy issue that really sees Silicon Valley and Washington and others at the same time. And that is the trade-off between security and privacy that is perceived. And, you know, now we've got Apple and Google soon to come out with products that can evade or frustrate any effort by the government to gain metadata on your communications. Talk about that tension and where you think we'll come down.
You know, I think it's wonderful to have the tension. It's a dialectic. And the important thing throughout the history of innovation, whether it's, you know, the looms putting people out of work, according to Lord Byron, or, you know, Plato and Aristotle talking about writing on, you know, and whether that will destroy rhetoric, is can our moral sensibilities, our social sensibilities, keep up with our technology? It happens usually. Almost every time we're able to keep up with it. You can maybe point to a few major problems where we've, you know, not kept up with our technology, the atom bomb being one of them. But nowadays you see a wrestling over communications technology and how much anonymity is good, how much privacy is good. Privacy and anonymity aren't quite the same thing, although people sometimes confuse the two. And we went too far, definitely went too far, with the eavesdropping that the NSA and others did. I watched a segment and actually talked to at one of our forums, people like Michael Hayden, but also the great reporter James Risen. It's amazing how much common ground they actually have, where Michael Hayden said, you know, I'm not sure we should have, our NSA, he was in the intelligence community, that we should have exposed all of this because we needed it to fight terrorism. But I agree. We're there defending the Constitution, so we shouldn't start putting people in jail, and it's good that the conversation occurred. So I know it's a balance. I don't know exactly where the balance is, but the people who believe that we should have total anonymity in everything we do, we've never had that throughout history. I didn't have that growing up in New Orleans. If I walked to the drugstore on the corner and bought a pack of Marlboro, it would be back in my parents, they'd know it in 12 minutes. But then again, we do want privacy because privacy is integral to imagination, creativity, expression, the free flow of thinking. So I watch it, how we're wrestling with balancing it. And instead of being appalled, I'm somewhat impressed with, especially in this country, how we can have such a debate and make mistakes. But then the mistakes are all over the front pages of the newspaper that we made this mistake. And suddenly we're trying to rectify it. I don't think we've rectified it yet. I don't think we've hit the balance yet. But I do think whenever we do something wrong, instead of it spiraling out of control, there's a balancing mechanism where things become public. A reporter puts things on the front page of the papers and people get mad that she or he did so. But still, it's good for the public discourse. So I'm pretty optimistic about our ability as a human species and our ability as a nation to debate this, hash it out, and strike the balance between being able to communicate with total anonymity and having a system in which courts and the government can sometimes find a way to say, based on a court order, these things happen. We haven't gotten there yet, and we certainly messed up doing it legally at first, but I suspect we'll get to the right place.
So I'm just going to end with one sort of fun fact that's in your book, and I have to say it's sprinkled with these fun facts. Tell us, what are the origins of the phrase debugging? Get the bugs out.
Well, we've ever since Edison and before, people have talked about a bug, being a problem. But Grace Hopper, who is one of the great programmers and helps create COBOL, but she's leading a team that's programming the Mark I and the Mark II at Harvard, which is the first big old electromechanical computer. It's got a few switches and electromechanical relays, and one day it isn't working, and something's wrong with it, and they can't figure it out. And finally, they open up, and they're looking, and there's a moth caught in one of the electromechanical relay switches. And they take the moth out, and they actually take a piece of tape, and they tape it into their logbook, and they say, we found a bug in the machine, we debugged the machine. And ever since then, that's popularized the notion of bugs in a machine. And I'm glad you pointed out, because the digital age is filled with wonderful tales and smart, funny people doing cool things. And as I said, I think we'll be a little bit less alienated from our technology, a little bit less worried about eavesdropping and snooping, if we understand how cool and fun and funny the hackers and geeks and geniuses and innovators and entrepreneurs who created this revolution were, just like we try to understand how cool the people who created the American Revolution or the Industrial Revolution or the Scientific Revolution were.
Walter Isaacson, thank you so much both for this book and this conversation.
Jane, it's so wonderful being with you, and thank you for all you do at the Aspen Institute.
You've been listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this episode were two conversations. The first was with Eric Schmidt of Alphabet and Google, and he was in conversation with Tom Khalil of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And the second half was a conversation I had with Walter Isaacson of the Aspen Institute. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to listen to our programs, to register for upcoming events, or to become a World Affairs Council member. This program was made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.